Okay, so this afternoon's here, I hope is going to be a fun one. But after all the time we spent on the Shlomo's building of the Beis HaMikdash, so now is when the stuff is going to start to get real in terms of back to Shlomo the person, right? Like we had all the weeks of everything was great, and we kept on emphasizing like we're enjoying this, everything's amazing, everything's wonderful. At some point, it's going to change, and because we know that Shlomo's going to get complicated. And this week, where we have Perek Yud, the famous Perek where the Queen of Sheba comes to visit Shlomo, so the groundwork is going to be laid. And as we'll see, there are kind of, I think, three ways to read the Perek we're about to learn. One where everything is wonderful and amazing, one in which everything is terrible, and I think the best way we should read it, naturally, right, which is the other middle way, right, with some nuance and some sophistication. So let's load it up. Let's start, and we'll see if everybody here agrees with me. Let's see. Okay, just one second. So the first thing I want to, we talked about this last week. So those who weren't here last week, it's good to refresh the geopolitics. There's an important geopolitical point that for us to have down clearly. As we get introduced to the arrival of the mysterious Queen of Sheva coming to visit Shlomo HaMelech. Shlomo in Perek Tes expended serious effort to take control of the main trade routes running through Eretz Yisrael. Traditionally, I'm going to zoom in for a second. The classic area where the Bnei Yisrael had controlled throughout the period of Yehoshua and the Shoftim was essentially the modern day Yehuda v'Shomron, the hills over here, and the mountains of here, close to modern day Lebanon. The two main international trade routes, one which goes along the coast, and you can see the red line going along the coast, it then goes across Emek Yisrael, which is a valley between the mountain chains over here and over here. So much of that, if not all of that, was not under Jewish control for most of the period of the Shoftim. You have the Plishtim over here by Aza. You have the Canaanim controlling the valley over here, the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. So after Shmuel wins a tremendous victory against the Plishtim down over here in Perek Zion, the Amorim, who are due north right over here, so they make a treaty with Bnei Yisrael. They're still around, right? All in the valley. Devorah, when Devorah fights against Yavin and Sisra, the Canaanim, so they're again in the valley. When the Plishtim come to invade and fight the final battle of Shaul HaMelech, it's in Har HaGeboah, which is on the top of the mountains of Hare Ephraim over here. And if you can control this this road, you control all the land trade that goes between Mitzrayim to Aram and to Ashur and to Babel. So it's very, very lucrative, very, very difficult to control. However, in order to really control this, at least from a natural perspective, you require chariots because that's chariots work effectively on the plains. They work less effectively in the mountains, and you need you need a serious army. So Shlomo takes control, the real control of the land trade route. We saw in last week he built up fortified chariot cities in Chatzor, which is over here, in Megiddo over here. Paro gives him as a wedding present Gezer, which is a fortified city right over here, and now Shlomo is able to take control of the land trade routes, making which is going to give him immense, immense economic potential. The second thing that Shlomo did was he took control of the sea trade route. Etzion Gever, which in modern day Eilat is down over here. We think of Eilat as part of Israel because Eilat is part of Israel, but it belonged really to the territory of Edom. Moshe Rabbeinu walks over here. When Bnei Yisrael go through Midbar Sinai, so they walk in this area. This area was not halachically part of the originally given out Eretz Yisrael. But when Shlomo is able to extend, David already conquers Edom in Shmuel Beis, and Shlomo extends control over the port of Etzion Gever. Once he does that, so now any trade which would come up from the Red Sea, down by the Indian Ocean, Arabia, Africa, comes up here, and then it goes along from the Jordan River. So Shlomo has taken control of that trade route as well. The Navi told us last week that Shlomo, in part of his alliance with Tzur, Tsur up over here. So they are the master shipbuilders in the Middle East. So Tsur builds his ships down at Etzion Gever. Shlomo runs the port at Etzion Gever. And together, this alliance of Hiram and Shlomo, which has already allowed Shlomo to build the Beis HaMikdash, now they're setting up shop with naval trade down on the south. So Eretz Yisrael, the great crossroads between the three continents of the old world. So Shlomo has realized the strategic potential, and he's going to use that to turn Israel into not just like a small local power, but an international superpower playing with the big boys, right? That's the dream he has. Now that fits into Shlomo's religious dream, which he wants everyone to recognize. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a Melech Malchei HaMlachem, as we've said many times, thinks that that's one of the main goals of the Beis HaMikdash. Everybody to come to Yerushalayim, everyone to be impressed with the Beis HaMikdash. So he wants the country to be successful militarily, politically, economically, religiously. He thinks that's all folded into each other. The question for us to ask, and really Perek Yud will begin to get under the hood of this question, is, are those ambitions bad? Are those ambitions good, and Shlomo pulls it off? Are those ambitions good, but they could be bad, and Shlomo, as the success builds, is gonna fall into problems. And basically, what I'm gonna try to argue is that, set it up from the front. I think the pshat of the psukim in Perek Yud, which emphasize Shlomo's wealth and splendor, I think the real simple read of the psukim is that we're very pro. We're very, very pro. Everything is wonderful and great and phenomenal, and then all of a sudden it's gonna fall apart at the very, very end. And I think what the Navi is trying to tell us is we have to get into the shoes of Shlomo HaMelech. Shlomo HaMelech is, like the smartest of all people, like tremendously accomplished and impressive, really beyond our ability to comprehend. How is he able to fall into the disasters which are going to come in Perek Yud Aleph? And the basic answer is going to be the Yetzer Hara works so effectively when you're doing things which you think are for good reasons. You're doing things which maybe can be for good reasons, but you have things which can be good and could be bad, and gradually, like quietly under the surface, the building looks strong on the top, but the foundations are getting shaky, under the underground, until all of a sudden, like a sinkhole opens up and the whole thing collapses. So I think that we're gonna argue that's what's happening in Perek Yud. With everything going great, we'll see quietly the Navi is laying the foundations for the is eroding the foundations of Shlomo's monarchy for it to all come crashing down in Perek Yud Aleph. And so let's see what we're trying to talk about over here. So we get to Pasuk Aleph. Umalkas Shiva Shomas es Shemea Shlomo L'shem Hashem Vatabo L'nasa. So the queen of Shva comes, she hears about the fame of Shlomo with the Shem Hashem Yud Kev Vavke, fitting the pattern we've had again and again, right? Shlomo is associated with internationalism and spreading Shem Hashem. This is good, right? This is positive. So she comes to test him, bechidos, normally translated as riddles. The Radak points out that the Navi says, shoma'as, she is hearing. Where the Radak says it is, it's this constant news, right? Like every day she checks, she checks the paper today, and more news about Shlomo, more news about all she's hearing, Shlomo, and it's all anybody can talk about. Constantly, she's hearing about Shlomo's fame. The Abarbanel says it's not a coincidence. It's something that isn't coming out of nowhere. Where is this queen of Shva coming from? And somewhere to the south, unclear if it's in modern Somalia and East Africa, or if it's on the Arabian Peninsula, like down by Yemen, but it's somewhere down to the south. So the Abarbanel says he thinks what happened was the end of last Perek, Shlomo began sending his naval trading ships down to Ophir from down from Etzion Geber. And so as those ships are going down south, they're spreading the fame of Shlomo. They're spreading the shame of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the fame of the Beis HaMikdash. And so word of that gets to Shva. That's the Abarbanel. Okay. Read a few psukim with just like the traditional pshat that this is riddles, and then we'll come back and revisit another way of reading it. What does she come with? Oh, she comes to Yerushalayim with camels laden with incense, zahav rav maod, incredible amounts of gold, precious jewels. She comes to Shlomo. She tells him everything that's in her heart. Vayagad la Shlomo as kol divareh, and Shlomo tells her everything. Lo hayadal davar lan al menamelach ashlo gila. Nothing was hidden from the king. So the Mefarshim explained, Malbim here is an example of this, that she tells the riddles, which have the hidden inner meaning, right? And Shlomo is able to penetrate the outside of the riddle to tell her, Eis kol asher haya im levava, right? He can penetrate to the inner meaning. The example the Malbim gives is the previous riddle we've had in Tanakh, which is when Shimshon has his riddle contest with the Plishtim. So Shimshon kind of cheats because Shimshon gives a riddle which is impossible to answer with just your brain. Shimshon says, you know, from food, food came from the sweet, right? So what the answer was, it's food came from what was it exactly? From the mighty, and I from the strong came something sweet or something. What it's supposed to reference is the fact that Shimshon had killed a lion with his bare hands, and when he came back the next time, he saw that bees had set up a beehive in the carcass of the lion. So, you know, you're not going to know that just from thinking. You're going to have to know that from looking around and finding that that carcass. The Plishtim can't do it, so they get Shimshon's new Plishti wife to tell them anyway. So anyway, Malbim says that's a great example where you have an outer riddle, and unless you have this like supernatural ability to somehow read the person's mind, you're not going to figure it out. But that's the Chachma Lokis, which the Malbim says that that Shlomo has. Similar to Yosef at Tzadik, right? He was able to just penetrate beyond what mortal beings would think that one is capable of penetrating. Okay. Again, that's one way of reading what's going on over here. We have riddles. Shem Shlomo is solving the riddles, and she is amazed. What happens next? So Malka Shva sees all of Shlomo's wisdom, the house that he built. I didn't see Mefarshim talk about this, but ask whether this is the palace per se, whether this is the Beis HaMikdash. It seems like it's Shlomo's palace because of the juxtaposition to his food and how his servants are set up and the clothing of his ministers. Basically, the tremendous wealth that Shlomo has on display, along with Olaso Asher Ya'ala Beis Hashem. Pasuk sounds like it's talking about the karbanos that Shlomo offers, although some of the Mefarshim say this means this incredibly intricate road that Shlomo had designed to ascend from his palace to the Beis HaMikdash. But anyway, she sees Shlomo's incredible genius, incredible building, incredible wealth, the lo haya ba'od ruach. And there is no more ruach in her. Pshat, the way the Radak learns this, is that this means that it took her breath away, right? Which is exactly, as we've said so many times, what Shlomo wants. Shlomo wants to amaze people with his wisdom, with his wealth, with what he's built. And it's all the Shem Shamayim, right? Because by being amazed by Shlomo, that will reflect on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And sure enough, that seems to be exactly what happens. It's true what I heard about you and about your wisdom. I didn't believe it. Lo ha'emanti lidvarim until I came here. Vatir ena be'inai, and I can see with my own two eyes. V'hinei lohu gad li hachitzi, and they didn't even tell me half. Right, so I didn't believe anything at first, but it turns out that the rumors only captured half of the story of the greatness of Shlomo's wisdom and his goodness. And then she bursts out into bracha. Ashreyana shecha, ashrey avadecha, elohom dim lefanecha tamid. Praise for your men, for your servants who get to hear your wisdom. And then yehi Hashem elokecha baruch. May Hashem, yod kei vav kei, your God, be blessed, who has chosen you to sit on the throne of Yisrael. Ba'avas Hashem es Yisrael. Look at the love of Hashem. He gives Bnei Yisrael this amazing king. And what's this king doing? He's doing mishpat and staka, right? This is like the best Kiddush Hashem of all time. No, the pshat l'psukim is that this is the greatest Kiddush Hashem ever. This foreign queen shows up, is absolutely amazed by Shlomo's wisdom, his wealth, and his building. And indeed, this exactly reflects on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Yehi Hashem L'kach HaBaruch. All exactly what Shlomo was ever hoping. right? It seems like the dreams are being realized. Again, the pshat here is everything is amazing and wonderful. Okay. Now, the Marikra is interesting. Marikra kind of picks up on another, you know, theme which is like underlying here, and there are all sorts of midrashim and things about this, about all these like similarities between Shlomo and the Queen of Sheba. Marikra says, when she says lo hayba od ruach, she admits my wisdom is not the same as yours. Right? Until then, she thought they were comparable. They have a lot in common. They highly value chachma. Shad the psukim is that she's coming to Shlomo because she wants to see his wisdom. Right, she's that's what's driving her, and the two of these people have a lot in strikingly a lot in common. Ibar Benel points out that this is not the first time that we've seen a foreign king bless Hashem after being exposed to the wisdom of Shlomo. Bar Benel points out we had the exact same story back in Parak Hey with Hiram, the king of Tzor. He was in the north. And remember, we explained that, right? When Shlomo takes over, and rather than try to attack Hiram, he realizes it'll be better off to have economic partnership with Hiram. So Hiram blesses Hashem, was given Klal Yisrael such a wise king. We said that was a wonderful Kiddush Hashem. The same thing is happening over here, right? She says, Yeshanokach Barach Asher Chafetz Bach, just like Hiram had said that. Great. So this is all exactly what Shlomo wants. I saw in some old notes around on Bazak from the Gush. So he points out that there are striking parallels between the visit of the Queen of Sheva and Yisro when he comes to visit Moshe Rabbeinu. And at least as far as I can tell, that all seems wonderful and fantastic. Both of them hear everything that's happening. In Yisro's case, he hears everything that Hashem had done with Yetzias Mitzrayim. In the Queen of Sheva's case, she hears about the amazing supernatural wisdom of Shlomo, l'shem Hashem, right? They show up, and they both burst out in bracha. Yisro says, Baruch Hashem asher hitzil eschem. The Queen of Sheba says, Yihi Hashem l'kacha baruch asher chafetz b'cha. Right? So they both hear the amazing things. They both bless Hashem. And they both reflect on what they've been told. And they say, oh, sure enough, What I was told is true. Now I know that indeed what they say is right. Hashem is the greatest of all the Elohim. She says to Shlomo, "It is true, right? It is true everything they say about you." And at least in my opinion, the parallel all seems to redound to the positive over here, right? Again, the same idea. Hey, what is Hashem? No.
In the last two lines that you're comparing.
Yeah.
So by Yisro,
yeah,
it talks about Hashem, Ki Gadol Hashem Mikol Elokim, but in the other one, it's talking more about Shlomo.
I hear you. She does mention Hashem like right afterwards, but I hear the. That kind of sets up like what is Shlomo, and especially we've said before, so I'm going to come back to is Shlomo's, you know, sensitivity and his feeling of connection to Yetzias Mitzrayim. What is the miracle for Shlomo to show everybody nowadays, nowadays being in his time, right? He doesn't have open Makos or Kriyas Yamsuf.
Was the it the
open
building?
The open miracle is his own wisdom, right? Like his wisdom is the supernatural evidence of Hashem's greatness. So just like Yisro is going to hear about the Nisim ben Aflos and be amazed, so she's going to see Shlomo's unbelievable wisdom and be amazed. Right, Shlomo wants those to be the exact same, but there is a key difference, and this is very important: is the danger in there,
right?
Right, because the minute, and it's this Shlomo can't help it, but it's built in. It's built into the system, right? He has this amazing wisdom from Hashem, and there's so much he can do with that, but the danger of Gaiva is it jumps off the page. Right. So exactly. right? It's the wisdom of Shlomo is being equated with the miracles of Hashem, and that's good as long as Shlomo appreciates where it all comes from, right? As he, the danger of getting carried away, that's exactly what I was starting to get to, right? Is the, and the, I don't think the foundations yet, at this part in Perek Yud, I don't think the foundations have been eroded yet, but we're seeing the potential for that. And this parallel brings it out. Again, right now, the parallel itself is good, I think. I think Shlomo's mission so far is successful. But you notice that last point. It's like, this could be dangerous, and let's keep an eye out. Now, should just share this. There's an interesting second pshat, which Amos Chacham has in the Dat Mikra. I'll be honest, I really don't think it fits the pshat of the psukim, but it's very interesting, and I want to share it anyway. If anyone wants to prefer it, then that's great. He suggests that the reason why the Queen of Sheba is coming has nothing to do with wanting to explore Shlomo's wisdom and ask him riddles, and it has everything to do with geopolitics and economics. He suggests that the Queen of Sheba is down there, and the minute that Shlomo and Hiram begin sailing up and down the Red Sea, so all of a sudden her traditional land trade routes are in trouble. He suggests that the reason why she's coming here is she has political and economic problems that she wants to discuss with Shlomo. He suggests that the chidos are not riddles, but the chidos are the problems that she has. That's Hadvarim Asher Haya Im Livava, the problems on her mind. Shlomo gives her advice. And what's going to happen in Pasuk Yud is she's going to give him all this gold. So the Dat Mikra suggests that this is basically a bribe for him to shift his economic policy. I it's hard for me to see how that fits the Pshat of the Psukim, I'll be honest. Rav Bezak actually likes it. He thinks that the parallel between Yisro and the Queen of Sheva is there to highlight the contrast, namely the contrast which he says Sheva, she's coming, she's not coming because of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, she's really coming because she's in it for money. Which, if you buy that idea, it's great, but I don't. I it's hard for me to see. The main evidence that he adduces to this is the next pasuk, and after pasuk Yud, when she gives 120 kikar of gold to Shlomo, which is an unbelievable amount. So the next pasuk says the boats of Hiram carried the same amount of gold. So he suggests, yeah, Hiram and Sheva are competing for the to get main economic privilege from Shlomo. And then in Pasuk Yud Gimel, Hamelach Shlomo Nasan Lemalka Sheva as Kol Chafetza, the King Shlomo gives the Queen of Sheva everything she wanted. So the Dat Mikra, he understands that this means that Shlomo gave favoritism to the Queen of Sheva, and he downgrades the relationship with Hiram. If that's the case, the way he's reading these psukim is that everything is focused on economics. Everything is focused on money. And if that's the case, it definitely already portrays, even at this stage in the Shlomo story, things in a much more negative light, right? That Shlomo is just focused on money and more money and pitting different kings and queens against each other. And he had an ally and a friend, and he turns him down because someone else gives him a better deal. That's how he's upsuck him. In terms of the Pshat, it's really, again, it's really hard for me to see. It really seems more like the traditional Mefarshim, who said she's focused on his Chachamah, she's focused on his wisdom, she's amazed by the divine wisdom that Shlomo has. And it's not that there's some economic, competition which is happening. I think the easier way to read Pasuk Tes and Pasuk Yud, Pasuk Yud Aleph Yud Beis, is the Navi then talks about just how successful Shlomo's overall policy is. Not that there is a competition. Anyway, I don't understand why Shlomo would choose a land route for trade over a boat route. I mean, boats are much better. And the boats keep on sailing, right? She's bringing in gold. The boats of Hiram are bringing in gold. They're bringing in these unbelievable Atzei Almugim, this sandalwood, which is a very rare wood which comes from India, and then they gets traded by the Arabs as well. It's amazing because it's very fragrant, like decades after it's cut down, it still has a beautiful smell. So he's bringing that wood into the Beis HaMikdash, and they're making musical instruments for the Levium and the Beis HaMikdash, right? It's all wonderful. It's all describing Shlomo's wealth. I don't see any competition which is happening over here. Now, that said, there's a very interesting thing that you find in Rashi. Pasuk Yud Gimel tells us, "V'amelech Shlomo es kol chefza asher sha'ala," everything that she wanted, milvad asher nasan la ki yad hamelech Shlomo, besides giving her like the hand of Shlomo. So what does that mean? He gives her everything she wants, besides giving her like the hand of Shlomo. So Rashi understands, gave her. He says that's chachma. The first part, giving her everything she asked, is wisdom. She was able to pick Shlomo's brain on anything she wanted. Now, what's the second half of the pasuk? Milvad asher nasan la ki yad hamelech Shlomo. So here we have to scroll down for a second, and you find something funny. In the Makaros Gedolos Rashi, you have this parentheses in small print, followed by the regular Rashi. The regular Rashi says, Milvad nasan la matanos umagdanos hametsuyan kan ve'inam metsuyin bimkoma. It means that Shlomo gave her gifts to his ability. So she gave him lots of gold and rare wood that you find down in her kingdom. Shlomo gave her treasures from his kingdom. Great. So they had an exchange of gifts. Again, you see, Rashi is not understanding here that there's like bribing and competition. Rashi is understanding that there's a diplomatic engagement over here. She's very impressed by Shlomo. Shlomo has good relations with her. She gets his wisdom. They trade gifts. And then she goes back home. Again, by the way, just like Yisro, right? The Yisro story ends with Yisro going home. She goes back home as well. However, and I've never seen this before, they have in here the following. It's a little bigger just to compensate for the small print. In the small print in the Rashi, what does it mean he gave her his kol chefetz, everything she desired? It refers to sexual desire. Ba eleha, he slept with her. Benolad mimena Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar came from this union. Behacharev habayis sha'amad arba meos v'aser shanim v'chelak kol shnim aser shvatim. And ultimately, after 410 years, Nebuchadnezzar is going to destroy this space. Mikdash meha arizal. This is from the Ari, apparently quoted from the Zohar. And somehow this got inserted into the text of Rashi in the classic Makaros Gedolos. Now this idea, right? Clearly, this is not remotely the pshat in the psukim, but the idea it's clearly getting at is that the seeds of the Beis HaMikdash's destruction are being planted here in the relationship between Shlomo and the Queen of Sheba, right? There's a sense that Shlomo is not acting entirely lishma. Again, in the pshat of the psukim, I don't really see it, but as we see the rest of the parak unfold, we can really begin to see where this is coming from. Now, there is a Gemara which has a similar idea, not about the Malka Sheva though. There, it's Gemara is really pretty uniformly positive, but about Bas Paro. Gemara in Shabbos, which we'll have to revisit a lot next week when we talk about Shlomo's sins. So it says at the time that Shlomo married the daughter of Paro, so Gavriel went down and he planted a reed in the sea, and from there eventually develops the city of Rome. Again, that same idea, right? The seeds of the destruction, the ultimate destruction, being planted in some of Shlomo's decisions over here. Okay, again, we come out of the Sheva story, and I think on a pshat level, this is like Shlomo's dream. It's like a Kiddush Hashem dream come true. All the religious ambitions he could want, and he's also making lots of money, and that's great. Now the Navi then continues. And I want to do a bunch of these psukim like straight, just to get a pshat sense, just to tip the hand. The Navi here is going to describe all the gold that Shlomo brings in, and we're going to know that that's a problem. The question is, does the Navi really imply so much that it's a problem? So the Navi talks about 666, that's interesting, 666, 666 kikar of gold that Shlomo would bring in a year. Besides the merchants and the traders and the people from the Arabia who are coming, local governors, all sorts of international commerce. And Shlomo has successfully made Eretz Yisrael the hub for international commerce. It's bringing in tons of gold. Shlomo is making golden, why is this guy? He's making golden shields right? Ceremonial golden shields for his guards. He's making golden bucklers for his guards, right? He's just got more gold than he knows what to do with. He has a fascinating throne, which we'll revisit in a bit, made out of ivory and plated with gold, right? Gold everywhere, gold, gold, goldity gold, gold. Skip the throne for a bit. The drinking vessels are gold. The vessels in the Beis Yahr Levanon, that was the room in his palace, is Zav Sagur. Remember, we said the Zav Sagur is the kind of gold where that gold is so good, all the other goldsmiths like close shop, right? If that gold is on the market, everyone else goes home because that's the only thing people want to buy that day. The Navi says, "Ein kasef lo nechshav bimei Shlomo l'me'uma." People, no one cared about silver. Silver was nothing because there was so much gold. The ships of Hiram keep on coming in every 3 years with more gold than silver. There's another reason why I don't really understand the Dat Mikra saying that Shlomo downgrades Hiram, because you have this pasuk here where Shlomo and Hiram, their naval expedition, is still clearly in regular operation, bringing in all sorts of rare animals and treasures from Tarshish. Shlomo grows beyond anyone else in riches and in wisdom. Everyone comes to Shlomo to hear his chachma, asher nasan Elokim b'kirbo, his God-given chachma. And when they come, they bring gifts. They bring soul gold. They bring silver. They bring all sorts of great things every single year. Now, I think if you just read the pshat of the psukim, it all seems wonderful. No, doesn't seem great. And even the way the Navi, we might feel uncomfortable with the materialism. Maybe. I'm not sure how much of that is us retrojecting onto the pasuk. But the way the Navi even mixes in the middle there, Shlomo's greatness for Osher and Chachma, and everyone comes to hear his Chachma that Hashem gave him, right? So the Navi is telling us, don't worry, things are good, right? People are coming to hear his wisdom, right? He's not getting carried away by the gold. This is good. This is good. Everything is great. Now, the skip throne for a second. Chazal did not think that was actually the case, right? The Torah tells the king three things he cannot do. He has to be careful not to have too many horses, not to have too many women, and not to have too much silver and gold. Shlomo is going to systematically violate these in the end of Perek Yud and the beginning of Perek Yud Yud Aleph. And the Yerushalmi is going to call him on that. But I think it's fascinating that the violation of the amassing of gold, if you didn't know it was a problem, it would be hard to find. It's almost like Shlomo, he's being successful and he's trading and he's engaged in diplomacy and he's showing off his wisdom and people are coming and they're giving him gifts and he almost like falls into all this great stuff. The first of the three, we barely notice the fact. You have to take a step back and say, wait a second, all this looks great. But what about the pasuk of lo kasef v'zav lo yarba lo ma'od? He like fell into it. It happened so quickly, so easily, so naturally. If you're not careful, right? It doesn't look like he's doing anything bad every stage of the way. He's just trying to be more and more impressive, more and more famous and renowned, and it's successful, and it's successful. But maybe, and the Navi may be giving us a hint of the pause over here, because in pasuk Chaf Gimel, which one does the Torah tell us first?
That's what I
De'ahamalach
was going to
Shlomo
say.
mikol malchei ha'aretz la'osher ulachachma. Why does Osher come first? Right? It's very, very quiet. I think the pshat is the Navi is doing this quietly, not like on one extreme. Like you heard some people say that it's just up and down, like ripping. He's materialistic with Sheva and Chiram. He's materialistic here. It's all terrible. It's not all terrible, but if you look carefully under the surface, it's not all perfect either. Osher is coming before Chachma. And the bottom line is that it is too much. And it may have been easy to do, and maybe good reasons to do it, but it's too much. Okay, just sort of before going on the rest of the parak to like finish off that whole idea and follow through with the other two averos, the multitude of horses and the multitude of wives. So we should just see a Barbanel as a cool thing on the throne, which I just, we should see it. Even the way the Navi mixes the throne in with everything else, like it kind of throws you off the scent of the problem of too much gold. Because the Navi actually puts some strange detail and attention to the throne. So it's made of ivory and gold. Okay, fine. There are six steps ascending to the throne. The top is round. There are two arms. For some, I don't know. I mean, I'm sitting in an armchair right now. What's the greatness of an armchair? I'm not sure. But the Navi has to tell us, V'yados mizeh umizeh. The throne is it's an armchair. Okay. There are two lions next to the arms. And then on the six steps, you have 12 lions, two per step. So, like, what, the Navi doesn't tell us what how Shlomo decorated his bedroom. Like, why tell me the detailed workings of the throne? With the 12 lions and six steps and two armrests and a lion by each armrest. So let's see what the Abarbanel has to say about it. I thought it was interesting. So he says, no question that this that the Navi is telling us about this because there are symbols here. Lermoz dvarim madiyim. There are symbols here to the throne. And here's what the Abarbanel thinks is happening. Number one says, why is it round at the top? Le'ir al hashamayim. The top is round, the hint to the heavens. Hilo amar shemin hashamayim himlichu. It's Shlomo's way of reminding himself that it is HaKadosh Baruch Hu who gave him the throne, right? So it's round above him because the Shemayim HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him the throne. Fine. What's so exciting about having an armchair? Why does Navi tell us, oh, there are two arms with a lion by each one? So he understands. Mishpat Alpi HaTorah. Right? Shlomo has to rest his arms, the arms of judgment. He has to rest them on something, though. It's not just his own decisions. He rests them on something, on the Torah. Why two arms? Well, Torah shebichsav, Torah shebaal peh, right? It was the two forms of Torah Kadosh Baruch Hu gave him. Why are there lions at each of the armrests? L'hagid sheneviyei Yisrael v'chachamem mefarshei Torah me'arayos gaveiru b'chachmasa. Right, the lion, the Nevi'im, we call chachamim, right, stronger than lions. So they are the ones who explicate the Torah. Very interesting. And then the six steps and the 12 lions. So the 12 lions are the shvatim, just like you have in the ephod and in the choshen. So you have the real goal is to have 12 lions symbolizing the 12 shvatim of Klal Yisrael. The Malbim adds a bit. He says, yeah, and it's not a coincidence that there are lions in every single step because the lion is the symbol of Yehuda. Right, so if that's true, so it's symbolizing the united monarchy, all 12 Shvatim, with Yehuda as a Shevet, which is in charge of ruling. Okay, that was just cool to see Shlomo's throne. But to come back to like the central point, sorry, that we're trying to drive home, which is that the Navi is giving us all of Shlomo's wealth, right? But it begins with Queen of Sheva. Amazing and incredible. The fame that Shlomo wants, he wants L'shem Shamayim, and he pulls it off with the Queen of Sheba. Then we have the silver and the gold, where things look great, but if you know underneath, it's becoming a problem. The Osher was mentioned first. So the last four psukim of the Parak talk about Shlomo getting too many horses. It's definitely not a coincidence, these all come together. Now, again, one could defend this. Shlomo needs horses to control the trade routes. Question is, does he need so many? He has 14. He has 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horsemen. Rashi points out in Divrei Hayyamim, it actually says there are 1,700 chariots because there are 300 kept in Yerushalayim. The other 1,400 are divided among those chariot cities, which again are there to control the coastal road and the valley. Again, the Navi tells us about the wealth, right? Cedar woods are like sycamores. That's how common they are. The silver is like stones. Chazal pick up on this. They say, earlier you told me that silver was nothing. Now silver is like rocks. So rocks are better than nothing. So the Gemara says, yeah, I think once he married Bas Paro, things began to erode, which again fits our thesis that things are eroding very quietly, right? That's like a very, very subtle point. Right, things are like starting to go downhill. Where does he get his sources, his horses? He gets his horses from Egypt. The Mefarshim have a struggle to understand what this word means, umikveh. Does it mean like a collection, like a pool? Abarbanel goes to Abarbanel shows that the Targum, Yonason, thought that kveh was a place. But they got their horses from Mitzrayim and from kveh. But okay, they got their horses from Mitzrayim, and then they're able to export them. Shlomo is able to export the horses to Aram and to Turkey, and so he makes a lot of money. Which again, right? If you control the trade routes, so you could, it's great. So Shlomo has chariots for his army. He also uses the control to get more money. Everything's great. Now, the problem is, you're not allowed to do that either. The Torah tells us you can't go. Whoops, you can't go to Mitzrayim to get horses. And Shlomo is doing that as well. But again, it's Lashem Shemayim. What's the problem? Well, let's see. Then all of a sudden we get to the next parak. We'll focus on the beginning of next week. And the Torah and the Navi tells us, whoa, Shlomo loves many women from all sorts of nations. And they begin turning his heart aside. Okay, so we have the money, we have the horses, and we have the women. But you wouldn't have noticed that there was anything wrong until you put it all together and you see what happens with the women at the end. The Yerushalmi picks up on this, and the Talmud Yerushalmi says Shlomo thought he could be smarter than this, right? He understands the reasons for these mitzvos, and he's smart enough that he can overcome them. He and right, he, I have good reasons. I have good reasons to do what I do. It's gonna be okay. You know what? It wasn't okay. All the justifications in the world from the smartest man alive, ultimately, it's gonna come crashing down. Even the wives, Rabbi Yossi says in the Gemara that he had positive intent. Right? Why did Shlomo marry so many of these foreign women? It fits Shlomo's whole program until now. Right? If I want to spread Yiddishkeit, I want to spread the power of Torah, the fame of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so I'll marry all these alien princesses, I'll bring them to Yerushalayim, and they'll all be amazed. And then, you know, they go home to their father-in-law for Yontif, so they'll say, you should know these amazing things we have in Yerushalayim, Shlomo and Torah, etc., etc., etc. Again, Shlomo is doing this l'shem Shemayim, but he's taking it too far. And we have to ask, was all of it really l'shem Shemayim, right? The other Tanaim disagree. The other Tanaim say that Shlomo's Yetzer Hara involved over here by bringing all these women in. And we could probably say that both of them are true. Shlomo tells himself he's doing this for noble causes, but under the surface, is that really all that's driving him? Probably not. And we see the results. The bottom line is you think you're smarter than Torah, and as good as powerful as the justification can be, right? It erodes quietly, imperceptibly, until all of a sudden you find yourself with things falling out of the bottom, which is going to happen at the beginning of next week. And there's one more interesting point that I wanted to highlight, specifically in the context of the horses, because it connects with the other theme we had for Shlomo that we've been developing over the last few weeks. And that theme was Shlomo's sensitivity to Yetzias Mitzrayim. How many times did we have the Navi telling us, giving shout outs to Yetzias Mitzrayim? And, you know, the Beis HaMikdash was built 480 years after Yetzias Mitzrayim. And Shlomo talking about, you know, since the Yetzias, now what happened, what Hashem promised us, Yetzias Mitzrayim now is coming true. And the Aron, which we got at Har Sinai, now is coming to the place where Hashem had always promised us. It's ending its journey. The Chanukah HaMikdash, precisely resembling the Chanukah Samishkan, which actually we'll read this week in Parsha Shemini. So Shlomo totally sees himself as a continuation, right, as a link back to Yetzias Mitzrayim, which we said the idea was the culmination of the Geula, right, the true redemption achieved in the life of Shlomo. Well, you can argue that something very sad that happens over here with all Shlomo's horses. It's interesting about seeing Rashi and the Ramban about the mitzvah of lo yarbeh lo susim. So the Torah says, don't have too many horses because you have to go back down to Mitzrayim to get the horses. Right? So only had enough horses for his chariot, says Rashi. Because the real problem, Rashi understands, the problem is not the horses per se. Horses are good. We like, they're good animals, right? We're pro horse. You know, cows, donkeys, all farm animals are approved. The real problem is going to Egypt. Shasusim boim misha. Because if you want good horses, you have to go to Egypt. And the real problem is the connection with Mitzrayim. There are three psukim in the Torah which warn against going to Mitzrayim. And this is one of the three. Well, that's the Rashi's opinion. Rashi's opinion is the real problem with the horses is Mitzrayim. Now, the Ramban is bothered by this because the Ramban says, well, you're allowed to go to Mitzrayim to do business. So if you're just going to go get some horses, what's so bad? So the Ramban understands that there are two problems. One problem is getting too many horses. That is a problem in and of itself. And then separately is going to Mitzrayim, because you're going to go to Mitzrayim to get the horses, and then you're going to set up like real enduring relationships with Mitzrayim. Okay, so that's the Ramban. But if we bring it back to Rashi, and Rashi, understood that that the Isser of Mitzrayim is only an Isser of business. So what was Rashi thinking? But I think if we get in the shoes of Shlomo, so we can understand why, according to Rashi, Shlomo may have thought that he doesn't have to worry about this Isser anymore. Why is it so important for us to not go back to Mitzrayim? Well, the Rishonim all have tried to figure out if it's Isser to go back to Egypt, then how is there a community living in Mitzrayim? Right? There's very ancient Jewish tradition, community living in Mitzrayim. In fact, the Rambam, who codifies the Isser to live in Mitzrayim, lived in Mitzrayim. So one of the main answers that the Rishonim have, I think this begins with the Yireyim, the one of the Baalei Tosfos, and then many other Rishonim say this as well, is that the Pshat in the Pasuk is that it's not a problem of living in Egypt per se. It is a problem of traveling from Eretz Yisrael to Mitzrayim, because what is that doing? That is erasing Yetzias Mitzrayim, right? That's erasing the Geula. Hashem took us out, and now you want to go back. That's exactly what Dustin and Aviram keep on saying, right? Bring us back to Mitzrayim. We want to turn around. We want to go back home. The climax of the Tochacha in Kisavo is you're going to be sent back to Mitzrayim as slaves, but no one's going to buy you, right? It's going to be like even worse, this return to Mitzrayim. But I think Shlomo may dafka have thought that I don't need to worry about this anymore either. Why? Because the process of Yetzias Mitzrayim is complete. As long as we're still, the Geula has not yet been achieved, so I have to be very, very careful with Mitzrayim, because we're on the road to Geula, and we can't turn around until we've achieved that level. But Davka Shlomo, right, who is so sensitive to the mission of Geula, he thinks to himself, once I've achieved it, so now I don't have to worry about this anymore. And you know what? From a geopolitical perspective, good relations with Mitzrayim is very helpful, because I can control the trade routes. They can supply me with horses for my army. I can use those horses and sell them to the north. There's all sorts of wonderful things that can happen if I engage into a close relationship with Mitzrayim, culminating in marrying the daughter of Paro. Right? But the problem Shlomo has is that just because you've achieved Geula doesn't mean that history is over. And it doesn't mean, okay, now we can sit back and relax. Right? It's a constant. Geula is not an is not a is not an ultimate goal. Geula is something, yeah, we try desperately hard and daven very hard to achieve, but once you have it, we have to keep up that same level of dedication and intensity. And the like disgust that we had to have for Mitzrayim while we were in the process of leaving it and getting to Eretz Yisrael, that still needs to remain in place. And I think that's like the core mistake that Shlomo makes. He thinks we have Geula, we achieved what we needed to achieve, and now I can just look from my own perspective, my own wisdom Hashem gave me, right? And he slides into that ego problem. I think Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal in the Tshuva Drasha, so it was by Shana Bet. So he quoted whoever is the Christian saint, whatever, who said, that pride comes before a fall. And I forget who he quoted. He may have just said the view of Yadus is not that pride comes before a fall, but he said that pride is the fall, right? Shlomo has the pride, and you don't see any like one particular mistake that he makes, but it is the very pride that Shlomo has, and it's just underlying everything he's doing, all ostensibly for good reasons, but it's all built on this mistaken foundation. And we'll see next week how it's all gonna come crashing down. The Navi is gonna go from being like invisible with his sins in Perek Yud to being over the top with his sins in Perek Yud Aleph. And then we'll have to understand how to deal with the Pshat and the Pesukim over there. But we'll wait for that until next week. So. hopefully everyone enjoyed, and